You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jake Carlisle-Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a reporter who visited one of the three clinics in Wisconsin providing abortion services. She'll share how patients and doctors are navigating the state's abortion laws.
First, Senate Republicans released their proposal for changes to the federal tax system on Thursday. The Senate bill differs significantly from the House bill, which was released earlier this month. The nonpartisan Joint Committee on Taxation said the Senate version does more to cut taxes on middle-class Americans than the House version.
Henry Aaron is the former director and now senior fellow at the Brookings Institution Program in Economic Studies. He's back with us for a look at the Senate tax overhaul bill. Hank, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into some of the particulars, big picture, how significant are the differences between the Senate version and the House version?
Let's focus on certain similarities. The biggest similarity is that both would cost about $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years in lost revenue net. There are some big tax raisers and some bigger tax losers in both bills. They differ in character. From the standpoint of individuals, I think the two biggest differences are that the House bill completely eliminates the deductions for medical expenses. The Senate bill doesn't. In contrast, the Senate bill gets rid of all of the deductions for state and local taxes. The House bill gets rid of some of them and limits others. Those are the two biggest differences at the personal level. There's been some focus on the difference in the number of rates, three or four in the House bill and seven in the Senate. That's really quite unimportant because, as you know and I know, most of us now do our tax returns either with canned programs that we do on our home computer or we go to an accountant to have them done. So the number of brackets is really quite unimportant and has nothing much to do with tax simplification.
Now, there's been talk of doubling the personal deduction, and if that happens, does it make those other changes you mentioned less relevant? If we're not itemizing our taxes, does it matter what happens to things like the local taxes deduction?
You're absolutely right. It's the doubling of the standard deduction in the House bill and also a similar increase in the Senate. That means that many fewer people will itemize their deductions, but it still leaves a great many people who will be doing that, especially in the relatively high tax states. Property taxes are quite high, for example, in New England. Income taxes are high on both coasts. So a lot of people in different states will continue to itemize, fewer than under current law, and that is, in fact, significant simplification because the need to itemize deductions is a source of complexity at the individual level.
And we mentioned the Joint Committee on Taxation saying that the Senate version would ultimately be better as it stands for middle-class taxpayers in the House version. That's something that Republicans have been shooting for or talking about, at least as we enter this process. Do you agree with that assessment?
I agree with it about, well, I agree with it, but I think it's only a small proportion of the distributional story. Much the larger part of the distributional story is that under both bills, the principal benefits accrue to people with relatively high incomes, in no small measure because of changes in the treatment of businesses and how they would be taxed. Businesses are mostly owned by people who are relatively highly taxed and have relatively high incomes, and they would stand to gain most from the business tax deductions.
We're talking to Hank Aaron from the Brookings Institution, looking at the Senate tax overhaul bill, comparing and contrasting it with what came out from House Republicans a little earlier. Let's stay on the topic of business taxation. There were efforts in both the House and the Senate aimed at trying to keep money from going to lower tax jurisdictions elsewhere in the world, leaving the United States and having income not taxed here in the United States. What is the Senate trying to do to that end?
That is the rhetoric that's associated with the tax discussion. But both bills would go to a principle called territorial taxation, in which the United States would tax income earned here in the United States, but it would either not tax or tax very much more lightly income even of U.S.-owned corporations from operations they carry out overseas. It would reduce the taxes on overseas operations. Now, under current law, the tax is such that many businesses, so to speak, keep their profits overseas. But in fact, as one of my colleagues here at Brookings has pointed out, businesses do have access to those overseas earnings under current law. They can borrow against them, and there are various other transactions by which they can make use of those funds. So it isn't clear to me that these reforms are going to do much to keep investment here at home. It will remain the case that U.S.-owned corporations stand to gain a good deal from carrying out operations overseas.
And let's look at the corporate tax rate. Both the House and the Senate would drop the corporate tax rate to 20% from 35%. The Senate would do it just more slowly, it sounds like, to pay off some of the other cuts they have, it sounds like. Is that a significant difference?
In the long run, it isn't. The timing makes a big difference in the scoring of how much revenue is lost through a particular provision. Remember that there are rules under which the Senate operates, the most important of which for this purpose is called the Byrd Rule, named after Senator Byrd from West Virginia. And it imposes some very tough requirements that are going to bulk large in the debate as it unfolds. Specifically, the Byrd Rule bars any piece of legislation from cutting revenues outside the 10-year budget window that is used for scoring these bills if the bill is to be can be passed by a simple majority. If the Senate parliamentarian concludes that revenues are lost beyond the 10-year budget window as a result of this bill, then it would take 60 votes to pass it. And that would reduce the likelihood that the bill actually could be passed. In fact, I think it would reduce it very close to zero. So there is a real challenge as to how to write the bill in a way that doesn't lose revenue outside the budget window. Back in the George W. Bush administration, Congress did that by simply saying, oh, well, the bill is going to expire at the end of the 10-year window, so it doesn't have any effect outside of that period. As it turned out, much of it did expire, but not all. Congress renewed some of it, but not all of it. So there's going to be a big fight over how the law or how the bill is written, and that's going to influence the specific provisions that remain in it and hence the politics that play out around this bill.
When the House plan came out and we talked to you, you said there were, in effect, a lot of tricks or gimmicks in the bill in part to meet those requirements. Do you see that in the Senate bill as well?
There's some of that as well here. There's one area, for example, where the Senate is not using a gimmick that the House did, for example, with respect to the estate and gift tax, which the House bill had expiring, but only at the very end of the budget window. That in itself would have cost revenue outside of the 10-year period, and it would have contributed to a question about whether the bill could be passed, the House bill could be passed in the Senate by just a simple majority rather than requiring 60 votes to stop a filibuster. The Senate bill is more straightforward in this respect, with respect to the estate tax. It simply says that a couple can have more than $20 million in assets rather than just more than $10 million in assets before the estate tax begins to bite. But that starts right away and it continues indefinitely.
As we wrap up, Hank, what is the next step now?
The next step is for each house to try and pass a bill within each different body. They want to do that as quickly as possible. At that point, the usual procedure is to appoint a conference committee with representatives from both houses. They then iron out the differences, come to agreement on a single bill that would then go back to both houses. The two houses would have to pass the same bill, and if they succeed in doing so, it then goes to the president's desk. There is a good chance that the House can pass a bill because the Republicans who are supporting this effort enjoy a much larger majority there than in the Senate, and there are not enough obvious dissenters at this point. The Republicans have only a two-vote margin in the Senate, and one member who has declared his opposition pretty much already, so that makes it very close in the Senate. So the battle is going to go on within each House, but even if each one passes the bill, there remains the very difficult task of ironing out disagreements and then passing it yet again through both houses of Congress. So stay tuned. If I were a betting person, I don't think I would put a lot of money on the success of this effort in the end, other than perhaps some modest rate reductions, which could be quite popular in both houses. But the full range is going to be very difficult to do.
Hank, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
That's Henry Aaron, former director, now senior fellow at the Brookings Institution Program in Economic Studies. He joined us for a look at the Senate tax proposal.